Hi, welcome to Playtonics. I'm Jords.
I'm Rocky, and this is the show where we adapt TV shows and movies and books and all kinds of fiction, really, into role-playing game sessions. We talk about what you got to prep and how you're going to run it at the table to make a session that actually feels like the thing that you're trying to nail. This month, we have a little bit of a throwback, a little bit of a nostalgia kick, something that I have rewatched recently. Jords, I think you will agree that you have got a friend in me. This month we are doing Toy Story, and I have got opinions about this. The reason I picked Toy Story is pretty... It lets us do a couple of things, and we have a very long list of types of stories that we want to talk about, and Toy Story lets us talk about more than one of them. So it's really an efficiency thing for us to get through a couple of topics in one go. Since this is usually your bailiwick, George, do you want to give us the, like, 60-second recap of what Toy Story is about? Not because I don't think anyone in the audience has heard it, mostly just because I want to know how the heck you summarize it.
Okay, so there are toys that live in the toy box. One of them's the leader of the toys. Everyone accepts that. But then there's a new toy on the block, and he rocks up onto the scene and smashes the current world order. And the old leader doesn't like this. It threatens his very identity as being the favorite toy. And everyone accepts him as being the favorite toy. So what does he do? Cause havoc. And then some other chicanery happens, and there's another kid with some weird toys, and turns out they're actually just misunderstood and abused all along the way. It gets quite dark when we go into that world. But there's like a great adventurer, and everybody goes out of the house and then comes back along the way, and then everyone makes peace and they're all friends.
Yeah, it's a pretty classic narrative. I think the one key point that you forgot there is the premise of the movie, which is that your toys are alive.
Oh yeah, probably should have said that bit. Yeah. The toys are alive, but only when you're not looking.
Toys are sentient, but you are, for some reason that is never explored, you are not allowed to see them move. So when you're not watching, your quantum toys come to life.
It is just like the ultimate tease. Because when you're a kid, you're like, oh, I'm playing with my toys and this world only lives in my head. Wouldn't it be great if they could talk back? And the answer is, yes, they can, but not to you.
They're just hiding it from you. They just don't like
ultimate
you enough.
Ultimate exclusionary thing.
Maybe if you were a better kid, your toys would talk to you.
Oh.
You just don't deserve it.
Oh. It's a brutal message. So let's skim right over that part and go to the more wholesome chicanery that occurs in the film.
That's twice I've heard chicanery this year, and it's on this show. Yeah, look, I think you touched on a couple of important things there. And so there's two things that have been on our list for a while that I have wanted to talk about. And Toy Story lets us talk about both of them. So one of them is what, for lack of a better word, I'm calling the Honey, I Shrunk the Kids trope.
Mm-hmm.
But it is like being small in a big world, which I think is great fun. And the toys definitely get to play a lot in that space. Pun not intended, but we're leaning into it. And the second one is the Prison Break. So if you look at it kind of structurally, every Toy Story movie is not at its heart, but at its shape. Because I think at its heart, it's something else. But in its shape, it is a prison break, right? So Toy Story 1, Buzz and Woody get stuck in Sid's house. Toy Story 2, they get kidnapped by Al from Al's Toy Barn, and they are trying to be rescued from the outside, even though Woody vacillates between wanting to go and not wanting to go. And Toy Story 3 is, I think, this is the one that I watched most recently. And Toy Story 3 doesn't even try to hide it, right? Like, it's explicitly, they get sent to a daycare, they get donated. There are, like, guard towers with searchlights and roving patrols, and they get, like, locked in toy baskets. So
we have tiny folk doing prison break.
We have tiny people doing prison break.
That's our trope here.
That's the two tropes that I think are ones that are on our list that we want to explore. There are some other things that I think make it Toy Story, that more Pixar-y stuff about, you know, love and heart and meaning. But like, I think those two ones are the ones that kind of, I think, are
the big structural elements.
Well, not even structural, but they're the things that I am most interested to talk about putting into a game.
See, I think this is one where we are coming at this from each other's perspectives, because I actually went down to the character level. For me, Toy Story is about every character having like an identity crisis. The thing that makes that toy them gets challenged every time. So like with Woody, it's his dominance as the prime toy, the most favored one, and being usurped by the cool new kid on the block. And he doesn't like that. And for Buzz, it's the reckoning that he's actually not an elite space ranger.
You are a toy!
Yeah.
Genuinely one of the greatest movie speeches of all time.
The lack of relevance to the whole community of toys as Andy grows up and moves on from them being a central part of his life. I feel like that's the bit that I really gravitated towards in here. The real character-driven aspect of it.
Excellent. So which half do you want to do first?
Let's go big picture. Let's go structure. We love structure because that informs content. So talk to me. Honey, I Shrunk the Kids. Small people in a big world. What are the identity elements that you have to make this game feel like that kind of a vibe?
It really comes into how you as a game master are prepping your environments. And I think my favorite example of this from the movies is the seedy crime den / club / poker night that is inside the illuminated sign on top of a vending machine in the daycare in Toy Story 3. And that to me is like, that is the perfect example of how you are should be like the kind of thing you should be looking to do when you're doing your prep for your setting, right? So we're talking like, again, really big picture here. This is like thinking about your setting. Where is it going to be? Is it going to be in a house? Is it going to be in a daycare? Is it a school? Like whatever. It's some everyday scenario. But much like you get in games like Mouse Ritter, where the players are playing mice and their sort of objects are these everyday objects that become wondrous and kind of mystical because they're so big. You kind of get to do the same thing here. Slightly bigger. I think the toys are slightly bigger than mice, but like you get to play in the same kind of space here. And so I think this is a really great invitation to come up with some really cool actionable environments, some really cool set pieces that let you look at things that are really everyday and make them strange and epic and gigantic and wonderful. So a car stops being something that is your scale and becomes a truly colossal, unstoppable thing.
Terrifyingly powerful at your scale.
And even things as simple as the baby monitors that they use to eavesdrop on Christmas, right? Like that becomes a whole logistical exercise to get that into place. Yeah, there's an invitation there to like really have some fun with your settings and to go and look around and stick your like phone camera into some spaces and do some describing of things that are around you. Like I am 100% sure that scene happened because someone at Pixar was in their Toy Story headspace and was like getting something from the vending machine and had a look at this, you know, glowing sign at the top. And they were like, I wonder what's behind there, and stuck a camera behind there, had a look around and like turned that into a setting from a movie. Like I think this is a really good opportunity to set it somewhere that is familiar, right? So your players are going to have, they're going to know what you're talking about. It's not like Fantasyland where you're going to have to explain what, you know, a dragon's den looks like. You can say it's the top of a vending machine, but then you get to make it weird and strange. And so what that gives us is a environment that is already familiar to the players. And that means it already comes with affordances, right? They already know how to use it. They already know that like probably a way out of the vending machine is through the like the slot at the bottom, right? They probably already know that they could knock out the power by kicking the plug out of the wall, right? Like, all of the affordances are already there because they're everyday objects, and yet you also get the bonus of making them a little bit, like, fantastical and strange.
And, like, so by the very nature of it, the task of kicking the power cord out is now a mission unto itself. Like, there's a whole arc in how do we physically pull this plug out when we are small and it is tough. So I think there's a great opportunity here for recontextualization of the mundane to make it wondrous and challenging
and big,
and you get to literally challenge epic. This is not epic heroics. This is the most mundane heroics made epic by the environment.
Yeah.
Like, the environment does so much of the storytelling here. And I think as a GM, you've got to kind of come with this real sense of curiosity and challenge your functional fixedness. Like, when you look at a small round thing and you're like, oh yeah, that's a coin or something like that. But to a tiny person, that could be a table.
Exactly.
When you look at the electronics inside the vending machine and you recontextualize, like, these wires could be ropes, all of these very simple things that you would just take for granted, how could you reuse them if they were small, or if you were small and they were big and they were abundant all of a sudden? How would you build a tiny society on these things? I think another really good example of this trope, of course, is The Borrowers and Arrietty, the Miyazaki film. The whole bliss of those films is just watching these tiny people create marvelous contraptions out of discarded waste.
Yeah.
And go on grand schemes so they can acquire a sugar cube.
Yeah.
And the way that they bring it back is tricky and hard and fun.
Yeah.
Like, straight up, doors are so hard when you're tiny because they're designed for someone that's, you know, about 75 centimeters or taller to be able to reach the handle. Like, in dungeon design, the door is often not the plot. And I think a lot of new GMs who get stuck in, like, a trad mindset sometimes treat the door as the activity, but the door is the interface to the activity that happens on the other side of it. That's not the case here.
Yeah.
Opening the door is the activity. It's logistically difficult.
The whole elaborate rescue slash escape plot from Toy Story 1 is to get the front door open, right? there's a Ocean's 11 style, like, multi-part heist with multiple moving parts and multiple, like, bits of the scheme that have to go exactly right just to, like, ring the doorbell and get someone to open the door so that Woody can get out. I think you're exactly right. I think if you're not looking at, like, yes, not just what interesting, like, affordances can this environment offer, but also, like, what are the challenges if you are only a couple of inches tall? And it is. It's things like doors and cars and crossing the street, right? Like, every little mundane activity can become a whole epic challenge. And I really love that.
Especially when you toss in the people aren't allowed to know that you're a toy, that you're sentient, that you're alive. So anytime you're in a public or open space, you've got to go limp if somebody sees you.
Yeah. So the nobody can see you thing is fascinating because it sits above whatever mission and interests and plans the toys might have. Everyone seems to agree you are not allowed to be seen by humans. Animals don't seem to count. You're allowed to be seen by the dog, but, like, the humans can't see you. And I think that's really interesting. I think as a game master, I had a bit of a think about this yesterday. I'm like, where does this fit in? Because the obvious go-to is, a human comes in and everyone has to roll a stealth check to hide. But you have to stop and think about how that actually is operationalized in the movie, because a check means you can fail and nobody ever fails, right? Like, you cannot fail that check. It is less of a in universe, it seems to be less of a, like, you should not. It's not a societal law. It's more of a law of physics. Like, you may not. Like, it is not possible for you to be seen moving by a human.
That has transgressed, like, once or twice in there, where it's like the toys are at risk of being discovered. And that's so heightened. There is so much tension in that because someone is breaking the rule.
Yeah. I think actually literally only once in the whole franchise. I can only think of that bit at the end where Woody, like, freaks out Sid and we actually, I don't know that we see it used again in the franchise. I feel like that's something they almost tried to like walk back. So I think where this one comes in, this is like, it is a given that everyone has to drop what they're doing and pretend and play dead, essentially, play plastic when a human comes in. If you look at how this is used in the movies, it's a pacing tool, right? Whatever issue is at hand has to be resolved by the time that person walks in, because then everyone drops, right? So it's things like Andy's mum walks in, everyone has to play dead, and then at the end of it, Buzz is gone, right? Like it's things like that. It's your way as a director to force the issue, to result, like force a resolution to whatever's currently being discussed. And it is your way as a game master to do the same thing, right? It is your way to be like,
cause the scene to change dramatically. Right. Even just like an intense complication, like if there's some chicanery going on where you're trying to get the door open.
That's three.
And then the door opens. And a person walks in and, you know, maybe it's Andy. He comes in, he wants to play with the toys a little bit, and he moves them to new locations while they're in the middle of the plan.
Mm.
So the status quo is greatly changed by how this plays out. And now you have to adapt to a new status quo.
It's a forcing tool to make things happen. It's
some sort of a mechanism to kick the plot along, you might even say.
Yeah, you have surmised the point that I was getting to. I think this is your, as a game master, this is your go-to kick, is like a person is coming, everyone gets, you know, one action as we go into like freezing and what is it going to be, and that is when you have your dramatic, I kick Buzz out the window, I jump into the bag of things that's being donated and no one can stop me because now we're frozen, right? Like it's that kind of stuff that moves the plot along. And it's also, I think you want to be pretty light on how you do this. It probably only as your kind of instigating action after your kind of intro scene, but it is your opportunity as the game master to be like, okay, now things are starting. Like we've done our little kickoff scene and now the story is beginning. And it is your chance to declare that things have started and kick them into gear without necessarily having those start of game like conversations continue to just roll on, and then it's been 3 hours and you're still, you know, buying potions in the marketplace. Like Andy comes in, he picks up Woody, he notices that Woody is broken. He gives it to Andy's mum, he puts Woody on the shelf, they all leave. Woody's been left behind, and now we pick up and everything has changed, right? Like Woody is now the broken toy. He's on the broken toy shelf with Wheezy. Like, you get to come in as the game master only a few times per game. Only really, I think, and if you look at the movies, it's kind of the same thing. They come in and they instigate, and then you get to do that as a DM. You get to come in and instigate and then walk away. Everyone unfreezes and they have to deal with the changed situation.
I really like that as like, yeah.
I think it's a gift. I think it's tempting to be like, we need a game mechanic for this, but I'm like, no, this is a game mastering tool. You don't need any
happens.
Exactly. Yep. You need no mechanics for it at all. You just say everyone like freeze in the middle of what you're doing right now.
I would prep music for when the adults walk in the room, when people walk in the room. And that's my like hard, the world is different because you can't act now. It's like a red light, green light kind of a vibe.
And you could whip around the table and say like, and how are you sort of frozen? But it is your like your gift as a game master to like kick the game into gear. And I think it's actually kind of brilliant.
All right. So we got this omnipotent being that can walk in the room and shut everything down and dramatically cause plot to occur. And we've set up this world of small people with big objects that they have to navigate. Talk to me about a prison break. Now, elements of a prison break, in my mind, they often revolve around meticulous planning.
Digging a tunnel with spoons.
Yep, digging tunnel with spoons is absolutely the prime trope there. Perhaps a nice poster on the wall to cover those efforts. But yeah, they're like clockwork apparatus when the plan goes off well. It's like, you have to be here at this time because this patrol will go past so that then you can manipulate that to trigger this event so that this door is open at this time to slide through. Like, it's very much space and time bounded plans for everything.
Mm.
But that's a lot of work to prep. What are the bits that we have to draw in?
Exactly. I think you can kind of join the dots from the other two to this one, right? You've got these small people in a world that is not designed for them, that is in many ways prohibitive. Like, doors are a huge challenge. Roads are a huge challenge. Any environment is difficult to traverse, right? Which makes escaping or moving anywhere, but in particular escaping, it makes escaping a challenge. And then you have omnipotent beings that can literally pick you up and put you in a new context and put you in an environment that you can't get out of. And so
it's very Lovecraftian in a way.
It kind of is.
Is Toy Story a horror?
Like, there are definitely some aspects to it that you don't want to think too much about because they're pretty... And they like... They
surface reads only.
Exactly. They edge like dangerously close to them in... I've deliberately avoided talking about Toy Story 4 because I didn't really enjoy it. But they're
and
like...
And Toy Story 3 was just such a perfect conclusion.
Yeah, but even... So Toy Story 3 raises the like... Horrifying if you think about it, like, what happens to all the toys who end up in landfill? Are they just like burned alive?
And then, yeah, trapped under the masses and eventually burned alive.
Right? Like, do toys feel pain?
That's innocence
lost.
Can
they feel pain? We don't know. That's never explained in the movie.
Yeah, but there are fates worse than death.
Exactly. If you take a toy apart, like, do its... Because we know that Mr. Potato Head's constituent components continue to function. Is that a property of his unique biology?
Man, that's messed up for Sid then, because he's effectively
right?
pulled pieces of toys apart and stuck them back together in other bits. So, you know, like, that baby's head on the spider's legs. Are those two things operating independently?
Right? Like, what if the ship of Theseus, what if the boards were sentient?
Ooh, we like should write a Delta Green shotgun scenario about this.
This is now a horror game, and like I would absolutely play that. But then the Toy Story 4 like aspect of it as well, which is like, oh, as soon as you put eyes on a spork and play with it, it is declared a toy and thus becomes sentient. And that is like again,
you have
skating
consciousness into it,
skating dangerously close to like. Explaining the magic of their own world. And I think that's one of the reasons that that movie doesn't really work because it tries to play too much with explaining the magic. And it's like, no, don't. That we just have to accept that toys are alive.
Has to be taken for granted.
Exactly. Yeah. We have to just accept that toys are alive. And if we dig into the whys and the hows of it, like you just got to like, no, close that box back
as up. Soon as we start flirting with that idea, you start to like extrapolate. So factories are literally birthing consciousness en masse. Like, where the toys are made in China, they are just producing sentient entities.
Yeah.
Like nobody's business. What's the natural end game of that? Slave labor. We redesigned the world so we can get all these tiny workers to do all the...
But also, like, mechanically, you know, as soon as you're like, oh, anything that... looks that is like made and then played with, say, is alive. It's like, okay, well, suddenly you're opening up the windows for your players to assemble something that looks like a toy, leave it out for a kid to play with, and then bing, it comes to life. Like,
straight up, just a packet of googly eyes is the perfect solve all for every problem.
Exactly. And it's like, okay, well, now we're just walking around like animating everything. And that's not also not what this story is about. So it's like,
no,
you can't.
That's Fantasia. That's a different story.
So yeah, I think a prison break flows really naturally from you have an environment that is difficult to navigate and you have beings who can put you in those environments. And it is just such a simple setup to say, hey, you have been lost. You have been donated. You have been stolen by the kid next door. You have been bought by a collector.
You are away from your home place.
It's literally, yes, it's like, what are the places that are not like home and safe? And it's so easy to put the toys into those spaces because kids like to take their toys out in the world. And it's a great opportunity to re-traumatize your players. Like, what happens if you go around the table and you're like, okay, who lost a toy? What was the like most traumatic time you lost a toy? It's like, oh, I left my favorite thing on a Oh man, there's two that come to mind, and one of them is much more horrifying. We're gonna like go deep into my psyche now. One of them was that I left my stuffed rabbit on top of the heater, and it came back full Two-Face with a like one half like charred black. And I'm like,
look, I was gonna save this for later, but a lot of the games that do play in this space often take a horror bent on being the small thing in the big world.
Mm.
And I think that's, you've just hit on the reason why game designers in their 30s are like resolving the childhood trauma of loss. Like, why did the world steal my innocence by melting only half of my rabbit's face and letting me see that?
Yep. Yeah, I don't remember how we solved that. But the other one is I left the same rabbit on a plane, and I think after, so maybe we fixed it. I don't know. We left the rabbit. We must have patched it up somehow. I left the rabbit on the plane, and they were like, oh, okay. Because my parents were clued in that this was the favorite toy, they had a spare of the same toy. And so they were like, hey, look, your rabbit's gone, but we've got, and it was a different color, but I didn't care because I was a little kid. They were like, your rabbit's gone, but like, we've got your rabbit's friend. And it's going to, this one's going
to
look
so after. From that toy's perspective, its prison break is trying to get back onto a plane, back to your place, figure out some sort of navigation to your house, and then sneak back into your room.
But then when they get there, they've been replaced by another one of the same toy. Like, it's just like chef kiss. And this is literally just like a normal thing that happened to me as a child. Like, I lost a toy and my parents replaced it with the same toy. But like, that could be a Toy Story movie. And I think you would be mad not to dig into, because that, again, that's the other half of this.
Heavy themes in this.
Everybody has these experiences. And so you can start to like dig into them as fuel for the plot, fuel for the like the structure of the story, because it is always a homecoming through a difficult environment. And sometimes you have like other toys trying to rescue you. Sometimes you have other toys trying to oppose you. So you've got some little teamworky, factiony things at play there. But yeah, it is essentially a like break out of one place, break back into another place, and like deal with what that means as well. So speaking of tugging at heartstrings and unresolved childhood trauma and harvesting players' experiences and that like familiar nostalgia, right? For you know, the good stuff at the table, for table content. You said you were thinking about this much more from a, I guess, heart and soul kind of view. Like, it's all about change and coming to terms with...
The characterization of the toys, I think, is incredibly important. Like, first of all, one of the prime takeaways from these movies is that diversity is strength.
Mm.
Because always the like clever plans that they come up with leverage all the individual capabilities of the very different toys.
Mm.
So I think there is a strong tie between like the physical presentation of the toy and their personality and the thing that drives them.
Yeah. I mean, they're literally features, right? Like the Mr. Potato Head has like, he has got storage space in him and he can change his appearance. And like,
yep.
Buzz has all of his like wings and lasers and stuff.
That physical representation of them becomes the personality that makes them who they are.
Mm.
And I think the two are inseparable. So I think there's a really strong element of what is my toy? What cool toy things can they do? And then how would they behave because they have those toy things?
Mm.
It's like Buzz always presents as the elite commando because he has cool elite commando bits on mm-hmm. him. And Woody always presents as the leader because he's the cowboy with the spurs and he's got some cool sayings and he's everybody's friend because of that.
Mm.
And, you know, Slinky Dog is just really fun and cool and always kind of looks a little bit high.
Well, no, Slinky's interesting because he's loyal like the dog, but he's also literally, but I guess also metaphorically flexible. Like, but then also, it's really useful, it turns out, to have a player who can just stretch, or a character who can just stretch. And so he...
That character is the rope.
Exactly. And so he becomes like... And they use that all the time. They are not... It's not like a James Bond situation where there's, you know, each gadget gets used only once. Like, they use Slink Stretch all the time. They use it to get down things. They use it to get up things. They're like, the limits of how far he can stretch behind the moving van is a whole, like, a whole moment. Like, they take that one feature and they absolutely, like, get to play
milk
with it. It's not a thing that you always get in RPGs. You don't always get to use your gimmick. But I think because the environment is so hostile, you are, like, you also get to have some affordances that are, like, yourself and that are, like, always on and always available. And I think it's a genre or a franchise that really encourages you to use them.
Absolutely. I think there's a strong tendency to recontextualize your cool ability given a new situation. So it almost plays a bit like in a lot of shonen anime, there's often like main character who might not be as strong or as powerful as somebody else, but they're just really clever with the one trick pony that they are. And it allows them to be extremely adaptable. And I think that's what our toys are here. They might not have a huge feature set, but the way that they can use it is so versatile and makes for interesting plot beats to occur.
And I can't think of any that I wouldn't enjoy seeing. I'm like, even the, you know, the Etch-a-Sketch, right? I'm like, what a, the way Etch is used in the shows is that they're a quick draw. They are really good at like visualizing things, at capturing information. If they need to capture like what's on the TV, the map for the map to the toy barn that's on the TV, it's like Etch, go. And I'm like, you know what? Absolutely a player who can like see something and immediately memorize it and sketch it out visually for the other players to refer to. So good as a like gimmick for your character. Also presents such a fun weakness where like as soon as they get shaken, the information is gone. Like, it sounds like a dumb toy to be, but you could make it work and have so much fun with it, I think, having someone play Etch-a-Sketch.
That weakness element, I think, is also pretty funny because all of your toys, you can imagine the way that they break really easily. So like Slinky gets tangled.
Oh boy, does
it. I challenge anyone out there who has ever held a Slinky to not know what it feels like when that bastard gets tangled. Great fail states that are unique to each character, each toy, but then also that personal driving element that makes them stick around and work together as a team to achieve something. It's like a personal ethos for each of the characters that is tested in each film. Everyone has their element that is pushed to its limit so that they can then grow as a character. I would want that to be, I think, a strong mechanical component of the game so that it ties so tightly to the fiction.
Oh, absolutely. And it's like everyone, and this is, I think, when we get to like the Pixar of it all, right? Because it has been, the stuff we've talked about so far has been like a little bit mechanical, a little bit gamey, but that like, this is the meat of why people love these movies. And I think if you don't have it, you are just playing toy soldiers. Like, it is change. You are right. It is like coming to terms with the, you know, the status quo that has changed. It is coming to terms with your like, changes in your identity and your purpose. Like, what is the purpose of a toy? What is the purpose of a favorite toy? Is it to always be there, or is it to move on and be someone else's favorite? Like, what does it mean to be around forever? Does it mean being loved and played with until you break, or does it mean being preserved and enjoyed from afar? Like, these are not small questions, and not only do they drive a lot of like, I guess, the internal change within the plays, they're also a source of conflict, right? Like that conflict between like Woody, your place is with Andy, your job is to like be there for Andy whether or not he needs you right now, versus your job is to like, you are a historical artifact and you can be loved by millions for generations. Like, neither of those is wrong, and that is the thing that drives the plot of Toy Story 2. They're not wrong. Woody picks a side, but like, neither is necessarily invalid on the face.
The thing that is wrong in there is when the choice is made for you.
Exactly.
When you're forced into it. Yeah. When you, like, loss of agency is the villain.
And like the way that you behave in attaining those goals. But it's not necessarily wrong to want to be in a museum, for example. Or in a daycare, for example. Like, we see how that looks. I think Toy Story 3 does a really good job at like not invalidating that that conflicted path when we see the daycare in the after times. It's like, well, Woody and the team have decided that it's not for them, but we also see the situation at the daycare change, and it's like, and it's no longer run like a prison. It is run as like a cooperative kind of, everyone taps out, everyone makes sure that they get cared for each other, and like to be loved by many kids rather than just one is like also a valid pathway. And we get to see that actually played out, which you don't so much in Toy Story 2. Yeah, I think that's also what drives, it's not just what drives our characters and makes our characters interesting, it's also what drives the conflict of the movie, is this like, what does it mean to be who I am in the world?
Who I are.
What is my purpose?
To pass butter.
What does it mean to have purpose? They're deep questions.
Oh, that's a harder, less memeable question. Right, so we've got small people, big world, recontextualization of everyday things as obstacles or challenges or affordances. We've got a situation that requires overcoming a bunch of these obstacles a la Prison Break style to get home, probably. And we've got, that ties really nicely to the last one, challenges to the personal identities of the toys, so that their understanding of what is right and what is true is challenged and maybe changed. Like, we have a reckoning for them to come to terms with.
Absolutely.
Is that Toy Story?
I mean, Toy Story is so many things, but I think those are the bits.
It's also got the strong aesthetic elements to it as well.
Yeah, actually, before we dive into our game system, I do just want to put in one last little, like, as I often do at the end here, like, and here's the like little like thing about props or music or table setting or lighting. Absolutely get some toys out. Like, I think you'd be so dumb not to. I think you'd be so dumb not to be like, everyone bring a toy. We're going to do a Toy Story game. Like, bring who you're going to play. And maybe that's one of their own from their childhood. Maybe that's one of their own. Or like they go to an op shop or something and pick up a like something that looks interesting. But I think you'd
be... That might be cooler than the thing that I was going to suggest, yeah. Having the physical presence of the toy on the table. Just imagining the bit where somebody's got Buzz Lightyear pressing his little arm laser and pew, 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 pew.
Right? Yeah. And like... What a cool chance to like actually play with toys as part of the game. And look, if you wanted to go real hard on it, I think you can't follow this too far to its natural conclusion, because it becomes a LARP where you're like hiding Buzz on top of the bookshelf, like in your house, and you're just running around like idiots. And that could be its own kind of fun, but I don't think it's necessarily what we're trying to do here. But like, absolutely bring toys to the table. What was your thing?
So I was going to suggest, when we're creating those characters, that maybe it is you take the element of what toy was broken, or like when was your heart broken because your toy was, or lost or something like that, in which case they wouldn't be present at the table, but you have that really tight personal connection and you can very much draw on your own childhood trauma of how that made you feel and what your characterization of the toy was, along with whatever abilities it has.
Like, I think this is why the movies work, because it's the world is so accessible, the setting is so accessible, but also the characters and the stories are so accessible. And I think you'd be mad not to use that as a game master. Everyone is familiar with the inside of a house, and everyone is familiar.
Slow down, egghead.
And everyone, unlike household objects, and everyone is also familiar with like what it means to have a toy that you like, but then lose, or your relationship to that thing changes, right? Like, everyone knows how it, because we are presumably playing this game as adults and no longer are playing with toys in the same way. Like, we all have that sense of what it is to have your relationship with toys change. That is a super accessible thing that you can draw on. And yeah, I think you'd be mad not to do it.
And just for all the Warhammer fans out there, the relationship between the toys being something that you buy once and you fool around with in many different ways versus meticulously paint and put on the shelf, and then they come down for special occasions to do war. It's like, there's a pretty cool identity in those little guys,
right?
As well.
Like, I would actually be like, heck yes, bring your, because you know the little like green army dudes in the movie,
yeah,
right? Like I imagine it would be a similar kind of, and maybe you're playing a squad of them,
except they are now a like quite strong, pretty fascist military parade looking group of dudes behind the glass cabinet.
Weirdly uptight because they're not used to actually being played with in the real world. Like,
yeah, they're not that kind of toy.
Yeah. And I like that. It's like, I don't understand how to be played with if there's no, you know, rules and dice.
I just imagine one of them like taking a hit and their paint chipping and everyone treating it as a mortal wound.
Yeah. Right? Like they get out like a field first aid
kit. You're no longer battle ready.
It's you take out a field first aid kit and it's all just like Citadel paints.
Speed paints.
And all the other toys are like, you're fine. You're not broken at all. It's like, no, he's not table legal if he's not fully painted. You can't participate. Oh, man. I want the toy story at Andy's college where he's like, his 40k miniatures also come to life. Just
doing war in the background to each other all the time.
Oh, incredible.
Yeah, strong element of identity, a drive in those toys. So yeah, I think I would definitely start this one, I think, from the characters outwards. Like, we know we've got a bunch of elements that are really easy to improv on the fly, like the layout of a house and the obstacles like doors and windows and literally just height. The concept of height is a really big player.
I think that would reward some scouting by you as the game master first.
Oh, yes. I think having that awareness, but like not necessarily prepping anything, just so much as familiarization with that world, in the same way that you might like watch a movie, but not necessarily prep a structure from a movie.
Yeah. And in a thing that I've just thought of, maybe some like, if you're getting your phone out to, you know, stick it down low on the floor, some like, it's a really easy one to make assets for. Like, you just stick your phone at toy height, tilt it upwards, and you have all of the, like, examples that you need of, like, how things look. Like, you come across a towering, you know, monolith, and it's a bookshelf, and it's your bookshelf, and you've just taken, a really low-angle shot of it, right? Like, it's actually a super easy one to prep some visual prompts for if you just walk around your house and take pictures of things from weird angles. And you don't have to use all of them. That doesn't mean you have to assign each one a scene or something that happens there, but if they do happen to try to escape out the window, it's like, I actually took a photo of a window from a toy's POV. Like, you can bring that up, and it's really easy to add some visual elements to the story without having to be, you know, an incredible artist who can draw fantasy scenes. But I guess the flip side of that is like super easy to do if you're just doing one around a house. It's actually super easy research to do, you know, on the fly.
Back to characters. I would want my players to be building their characters with that strong identity element, a singular drive statement that says, this is why I do what I do and what my like ideal home place would be, how I like the status quo. And it might not be that you're the favorite, but it is that you're loved by all the other toys. It might be that everyone in the household plays with you at some point.
Mm.
It might be that you're bonded tightly to one person in particular. That gives cause to be challenged at some point. And then I would start looking at those structural things of obstacles, which we've already covered a bunch. Doors, windows, height, family pets, the outside. I really like birds. Like, I really want to have, if somebody goes out into an open space, I want a thread of birds swooping them to be one. Yeah. And I live in a neighborhood that has several different gangs of magpies, and I just imagine them curiously.
I was gonna say, you are shiny, and you will be added to a bower.
Or like the full on eagle comes down, like a wedgetail comes down, is like food, and then takes you back to a nest, and is like, you're not food, but there are lots of little babies here that want to eat you now. So yeah, having a couple of those in the back pocket, and like an inciting incident. Like, what's the big thing that's going to upset the status quo here? Is that child gets old?
Well, yes, but also that's where your, I think as your like actual like instantaneous sort of moment of change, I think that's really where your humans come into the room, everyone has to freeze, comes in as a way to kick things up. So, yeah.
I would want to have an opening scene before that happens just to establish this is the you meet in a tavern, but it's Toy World.
Yeah, and you get that in the movies as well, and that's when we actually get to, at least at the start of Toy Story 2, we get to see into the, like, fantasy world that Andy is constructing. I think one of those as an opener is actually great, great fun. Because it doesn't need to make sense. It doesn't need to be anything other than just, like, narrating what happens.
You just get to play with the toys you in your toy box.
I know, and it's like, is that what we're doing? Is that all we've invented is a way to play with toys and have it be part of and our RPG okay. night?
Well, I love how we use that euphemism in so many other contexts, and this time it's extremely literal.
Literally go play with your toys.
Yep. This works especially well if the players have brought toys to the table, and then you just get to play a scene while they watch. That'd be so weird and fun.
Yeah, we're just doing the intro scene, and it's just like freeform kind of narrator. It's like you're literally just you're playing with the toys. You're playing make believe with the toys.
And then inciting event occurs.
Yep,
which dramatic status quo change,
which I think is canonically becoming the toys becoming separated from whatever their concept of home is.
Yep. Yeah, been removed for a reason. And then the rest of the game is overcoming obstacles on the way back. And I think I would have a couple of fun set piece obstacles.
Mm.
And I don't know that I'd necessarily worry about prepping the transitions. I think I would play with the contextualization in the moment. I would improv that.
Yeah.
We've already done the hard work of pulling out, like, car is very scary. Like, a bus is scary. If you have to travel overland, that's scary. Now it's just a matter of, like, where do the players want to take it? And then jumping on board with that.
Yeah. So, yeah, I think prep-wise it is super easy. I think it's you prep an inciting incident, you prep some, like, interesting environments, and you plop the characters far from home and let them make their way back.
In terms of the prison break element, I was thinking before, like, prison breaks, for me, conjure blueprints on the wall, people sitting around in the dark trying to discuss the plan, mapping and timing, like, guard routes and, like, very detail-heavy things.
Yeah, they're almost heists, but with the thing that you're heisting being yourself.
Yeah, you're heisting with no resources, but cleverness and time. Like, really primitive tools. I think the primitive tools aspect works well for our toys. Like, their biggest tool is their toy set features.
Yeah.
But I'm not going to be prepping meticulous guard routes and watchtower sight lines and floor plans and blueprints. That bit's not so fun for me to do, especially when I know that the players might just avoid that entire section of prep. So in that case, I would recontextualize that as, like, what are the fun beats of a prison break? And then we throw them out at the time. So if we set up an environment, so the adult has come in and thrown everyone into the bag and they're taking them to be donated to charity. And that's our inciting event. What can I recontextualize as a guard tower? What can I have as the guard walking past, which I think is incredibly fun when it's just a person and you have to become an inanimate object as soon as they spot you. That's way more interesting than in a, like, 5e style heist where it's like you roll stealth, oh no, you miss, oh, the alarm's gone up, and now it's a big pylon as the guards come pouring in. No, in this case, if you're at risk of being spotted, you literally turn inanimate, you get captured.
Yeah, you get picked up and put away.
Put somewhere else. Yeah, and the scene changes. And because that scene has changed, some of that prep, if I was meticulous about it, would no longer apply very well. I don't want to have to redo that on the fly. So yeah, recontextualizing is just like, these are the story beats of a prison break, and I know which one to deploy based on what's happening in this fiction right now.
Mm. So, are we ready to move on to systems?
I think we are. I think we've got the elements. We got toys that have a strong identity and a feature set. We've maybe got them physically present at the table. We've got a couple of lists of obstacles that they might face from toy perspective and affordances that we can pull out based on the change in function when things are small. We've got like an inciting event and a couple of kicks that we've prepped of when adults will walk into the room, or sorry, people will walk into the room, and your toys naturally lose the ability to act. And we've got a couple of Prison Break story beats, like being chased by the guards, like escaping through a patrol, like overcoming physical obstacles in your way that can be tied to whatever the scene is that we're currently in. Mm-hmm. I don't think we need anything more.
No, but there are some tools that I think I want as a game master, mechanics wise, that whatever system we do this in, there's some things that I want to be able to have at my disposal, or to have my players have at their disposal, because having rules for how to do things makes them easier to do. So should we talk a little bit about what we would run this in?
Absolutely. You sound like you've got something front of mind right now.
I do, and it's what you would expect.
Wait, can I say mine first then, just in case? Okay,
yep.
It's Fate.
Yes. Wait, is that yours or is that you guessing mine?
No, that's mine. I sat down for a while thinking about how to mechanize these wildly different toys, and I was like, it's got to be some sort of a universal mechanism where you can pull these traits of, but I'm very flexible, or I can be long or short, or I've always got the right thing to say when you pull the back of me to inspire the group. The spectrum of what toys and features they can have is so broad that to model that with an overly mechanized system, I think would take away some of the magic.
Yeah, so I'd go one step further and I'd say specifically Fate Accelerated. So Fate actually has a very classic list of like skills. Like they're things like athletics and burglary and like drive a vehicle and, you know, shoot. And I think that's not granular, or that's too granular, sorry, for what we're kind of talking about. So I would go with Fate Accelerated, which replaces the skill list with what they call approaches, right? So rather than having like burglary and, you know, athletics, you've got how you approach the problem, which is careful, clever, flashy, forceful, quick, or sneaky. Which I love, because it also, like, much more, I think, than saying, oh, well, this character has a high stealth skill. What does that tell you about them? Well, we can kind of figure out what it might mean, but, like, this actually gives you something much more chunky to roleplay, which is, like, how am I approaching this problem? Mm. How do I like to approach problems? And the system kind of encourages you to approach things in the way that is best for your character, because you've got that really good ludonarrative resonance where, like, what is most in character for you is also what you are mechanically best at. So it's like, if you are a very careful character, you are going to do best if you take a careful approach, if you get to roll careful and set things up so that you get to roll your careful. So I think Fate Accelerated is the way to go, because, the skills are too diverse. It doesn't make any sense to be talking about Woody's athletics versus, like, Buzz's shoot, like, nonsensical. But we can talk about, like, Woody's careful over Buzz's, you know, flashy, right? Like, that makes much more sense as a way to talk about these characters. There's a couple of other tools in the Fate toolbox that I really like. So I think aspects, so the way Fate has you create aspects at the table encourages you to create relationships with other characters. So some of your aspects will be about your relationship with another character at the table. So you have your kind of core identity, and then you have a usually some kind of flaw, and then you will have like relationships with the people to either side of you. And I think that's a really cool way to start to have relationships in the game. So you have, for example, Woody and Buzz have a very strong rival relationship, mm-hmm. which is perfect. That becomes a mechanical thing that you can compel as the game master, but there's also rules as part of the game for changing aspects as you, I think, and I'd have to go back and check how it works in Accelerated, but it's as part of the like leveling up process, you can add an aspect or change an existing aspect when you grow as a character. So you have these rules for like changing those relationships and changing your core like identity, sense of purpose as part of the game system, which I love.
Yeah, I think all of that ties super tightly to the sort of things that I would want to be preparing anyway. And like you said, coming up with those aspects is quite easy to do and mechanically robust.
Mm.
I do really like the flexibility of an approach over a skill list.
Yeah. The other thing I really like is, so you have your approaches, which is kind of your over the shape of your character. You've got your aspects, which is more specific. I'm this kind of toy. I have these kinds of relationships. Then you have your stunts. So stunts are a little bit less like skills that you roll and a little bit more like quote unquote powers that you have, but they're very free form in how you design mm-hmm. them. So stunts are great. Stunts are a really good fit for that like toy features space where it's like, it's something quite mechanically specific that's maybe only situationally applicable and that you're going to try to activate as much as you can through the game because you only have one, maybe two of them. Look, without going through the whole, because I could talk about Fate all day, but I think the last thing that's a really good fit is consequences. It's one of those games where you take stress, and then when your stress builds up too high, you take a consequence.
Mm-hmm. This is starkly different to something like a Mouse Ritter, right? Where death is on the cards.
Mm, absolutely.
If your mouse gets hurt, they die. And that's not something that's really reflected in a Toy Story space.
No, you might be changed. You might, be impaired in some way, but you're not going to die.
Die. Yeah, I think that's really important. I think the nature of consequence here is that, like, your identity might change. Your physical appearance might change. You might become battered or worn, or one of your features might break. But you're never just straight up removed. There's no element of going down. There's no element of being destroyed. And I don't think that should be reflected in the rule set that we choose to play this out. Just like you were saying before about a stealth check implies the possibility that you can fail and be caught, but that doesn't reflect this game. Death doesn't reflect this game. Now, I did have one other suggestion that takes a bit more work, I think, but it's got some of those elements that I think would really help model out this fiction. And that's a Modiphius 2D20 style game, of which I don't think there is one that maps to it.
I feel like you've talked about this on the show before, but I'm still not super familiar with it.
I have before. This is the one that Dune is based on. Dune, Conan, the Modiphius version of it, which I think they've lost the license to now, so you probably won't see any more of that. And Star Trek, if I remember correctly. In this one, there are a lot of different levers that the GM can pull when they call for a roll about setting like the number of successes that are required, what the threshold for success is. And you're always rolling at least 2d20, and you can roll more depending on what like traits your character has or elements from the environment you can invoke. But one of the key aspects here is that your characters have really strong personal drives. And if you act against that drive, you do have, like, there is a mechanized way that causes you to rethink that and reshapes who your character is. And I think that strong identity element comes through here, where you say, like, I would go against my identity to help my friend in this scene or to overcome this challenge, but who I am changes because of that. I have demonstrated in fiction that I'm not the person I thought I was anymore. And it also has another fun element called momentum, where if you succeed over and above the target that you were trying to achieve, you bank those successes as a group and you can call on them later. So for the next role, you get to do more. And I think this works quite well in the prison breaky aspect, where typically in a prison break scene, you'll overcome an obstacle, the next one, the next one, the next one, until it all comes crashing down. And that's that bit where you've run out of momentum.
Mm-hmm.
And this is kind of similar in Fate, in that these things are exchanged as metacurrencies. It's a game full to the brim of metacurrency. So if you don't like it, you probably won't vibe with it. But you do exchange these metacurrencies with the GM, who can pull them up to complicate scenes and add more obstacles or bad guys or whatever it may be. But it would require quite a lot of reflavoring to do it. I don't think it's too tricky to pull off, but I think you'd have to do quite a bit of legwork at the front end to make this sing.
Yeah, So that's twigged some thoughts. I have two ones that I want to just ask you about real briefly. The first one is, how would you feel about doing it in something powered by the apocalypse? Because I know the shifting towards one ideal or the other really reminded me of Avatar Legends.
Mm-hmm. I thought the same thing as well. I might just be a bit naive here. I don't know of one off the top of my head that's already written for this. I've seen a couple that play in the like toys but spooky and toys but horror sense that we chatted about earlier. But I feel confident that something probably exists in there. And I think it would also be a very good fit. I think the paradigm of PBTA would fit this story quite well.
Yeah.
And also typically helps with a low prep style game.
I think probably what you lose is that PBTA does tend to be based on, like, I guess, pre-existing classes a lot of the time.
Yeah, archetypes.
It's not quite as easy to, like, write your character sheet at the table unless you had a system that was kind of set up to let you do that.
Yeah, I think that one very much depends on the implementation of the PBTA principles, where some are more closed than others.
I think if you are trying to do a product, like design a product, design a game, and not plan a session, I think PBTA would be the go. I think you'd sit down and write a really good PBTA Toy Story game, but unless that already exists, it's a lot of work just to play one session when fate is right there.
And I think there's quite a lot of depth to the design of the moves. So if you're not already familiar with those principles and where to draw the line between like GM authority and shared player authority, I think people might not appreciate just how clever some PBTA designers are in the way that they sketch out their moves.
Like, I would happily run a PBTA Toy Story game. I will freely admit I am not up to designing one. Like, I don't have the chops. My other, like, quickfire question to put to you is, we talked a little bit about, you know, heisting and elaborate plans. Thoughts on a Forged in the Dark?
Look, you know that I'm a stand for this, but I just think there are too many elements that you would have to cut or change. So the like Forged in the Dark is a clever weave of two different games, right? There's the in-score elements to it, and then there's the factional elements that play out over a campaign. In the nature of the story that we've planned out, I don't think those factional elements really evolve that much. They're more a given. Mm. And as a result, like a lot of the consequences that you can throw at the table then get neutered, where, you know, you're standing with a particular faction increases or decreases because you took these actions. Or like the heat mechanic would have to be reflavored entirely, because at no stage do you get a higher chance of being discovered by the people, which is, I think, the easiest one-to-one correlation there. So I think at best, then, you'd be trimming it back to something more like a Cyber Plus Punk, which just lives in the session, and I think could work okay, but I just don't think it's as tight as something, like, ties as well to something like a Fate. Like, could be done, but, like, it's too much, like, squeezing 5e into it, you know?
I was about to say, while we're talking about could be done, but...
Yeah. I absolutely would not do this in 5e.
Oh, I just don't think there's any point if you're not getting to play with the, you know, toys. I think you'd spend far too long trying to write ability, like, you know, character abilities for 10 different types of toys, and I don't think you'd actually get to play.
Plus five to slinkiness.
Right, like it's...
When you're rolling a d20 and adding a modifier, the modifier has to be huge to more convincingly affect the roll. And if your one thing that you're really good at is being a slinky and you have to roll for that with a significant chance of failure, it's not a really good modeling of that fiction.
Yeah.
And if you overcome that by saying, well, you've got expertise in it and you've actually got plus 10, well, then why are you doing this at all?
Yeah.
Like, it's fighting the system as opposed to playing well off it.
No, yeah, you're exactly right. Just so it's on record, I also probably wouldn't bother in 5e. If you're a Mad King 5e head, what you can do is, I think, borrow some of the stuff from this and run a really good Honey, I Shrunk the Kids. If you drop the Pixar-like story with heart vibes, if you drop the people can't see us mechanics, and if you drop the like the bit where they're toys and have their own little like special features.
Then you'd be playing Mouse Ritter.
Kind of, yes. You could get a similar kind of vibe just by like shrinking your players, having them plucked out of whatever and having their task to be, you know, getting back home. And I think you can hit a lot of the same beats, but I don't think you can make them toys. I think it just becomes a you've been shrunk story. But you can, like, you know, you can still have loads of fun with your environments. I think you can still have loads of fun with challenges.
I think it works at low levels.
As soon as they get access to the enlarge spell, it's all over.
I was thinking fly, because fly just undoes a lot of spatial relationships and spatial problems.
That's true.
It's like, oh, you're really small, but you can just fly. You can reach that doorknob easy. No big deal.
You don't want them to have fly. What you want them to have is the lesser known spell fall with style. Which actually, now that I think about it, might just be Featherfall.
It is. I definitely thought that's what you're going for there.
So yeah, look, that's one of the reasons I wanted to do this ep, is because you can't necessarily do Toy Story in 5e, but I think if that's the kind of story that you're interested in telling and you have some lowish level characters, or you're happy to DM fiat away the enlarge spell, then I think as a structure for a... we've all been shrunk. As a structure for a that kind of little couple of session, one-shotty, mid-campaign type story arc, I think you could do a lot worse than looking at Toy Story.
Right. That's it. We've done Toy Story.
We've done Toy Story.
We've done Prison Breaks. We've done Small People, Big World.
Yep. We've done, once again, buddy movies and going through personal change and trauma at the table.
Man, that's such a weird element to always keep coming up in these stories we tell each other at the table. It's so strange.
We've done a good excuse to get all of your toys out and just play with them.
Yeah!
And that's really all we want.
Bring that 2,000 point army out of the cabinet to the table.
Not like that! Cool. So look, thanks for tuning in, everybody. This has been Playtonics. I've been Rocky.
I continue to be Jords.
CJ, continuously Jords. Continuing Jords.
The continuum of Jords.
So you can find us, obviously, wherever you listen to your podcasts, because you're listening to them right now. Keep that up. We love it. We're also online on a website at playtonics.net. You can find all of our old episodes there, show notes, transcripts, and our newsletter. We're on the text-based socials, so Blue Sky, Mastodon, and Threads. We're on Reddit under u/Playtonics. I tend to run the text-based socials, and they're mostly snark about whatever media I'm consuming for the show. The Reddit is mostly Jords, and it tends to be much more substantive and thoughtful commentary about role-playing games. So pick your poison there.
And over the last couple of weeks, recommending Shadow of the Weird Wizard.
The place we'd really love to see you, though, is on Discord. There's an invite link in the description or in your show notes, and we would love to have you hop in there and share your hot RPG takes, and also what things you'd like to see us, you know, pull apart and put back together on the show. We are always looking for ideas, and sometimes we get to do multiple ideas in one episode, like we did today. The last thing I will ask you to do is, if you have enjoyed listening to this and you want to give it a go, please send it to your game master. If you are a game master, please send it to one of your other game master friends. And if you do that and successfully run some of the things that we have talked about on the show, hop on the Discord and tell us. We would love to hear about people putting them into practice. All right, that's the show. Thanks so much for joining us. You've got a friend in us. And we'll see you next month.
Love you, boy!
Love you, boy!